God bless us as we accomplish them in His name. Sunday before last, I made an effort to go back and pick up a whole bunch of you that I felt like we had left standing on the station platform. And I hope that you feel sufficiently gotten and sufficiently along with the rest of us old folks who've already begun our marriage. But that was the purpose of it. You know, we discussed the ways of beginning and maturing relationships. We talked about this relationship here of just learning to get along in a friendly sort of way with the opposite sex and learning to enjoy that kind of relationship. It would usually then sprout to this, the hand-holding or the contact there, and then eventually, hopefully, it'll turn into this, where you turn toward each other seriously, and then hopefully as you grow, you'll add this dimension where you turn and provide protection for each other's back, their unguarded blind side, and make up for the lack and want in the other person's character. And that these things are not just phases through which you pass, they are stages in life that you add to the other dimensions in becoming a well-rounded person. I want to make two observations. There were two classes of you last Sunday that I mentioned that I want to make some observation about further, just very briefly by way of introduction. One of these comments has produced no feedback to me. The other comment has produced much feedback to me. The one that has produced no feedback had to do with the Cathcart cuddling Cupids. You know, I mentioned last week that they were the very expressive ones and their relationship was primarily physical. I want to say this about that group of young people. These expressive, responsive ones, once they ever get their priorities ordered and make God really the Lord of their life, they make some of the finest Christians that are going around today. You just watch them. These who have a great capacity to express and to respond whenever they get their priorities right and get God as the Lord of their life, they just become tremendous Christians. And I take my hat off to you, and we're going to wait on you. We just hope that you'll put your eye on the Lord and begin growing up to where you can be that kind of Christian that you ought to be, and that you particularly, in a peculiar way, are qualified to be. The other comment that brought some feedback was the remark that was made to the ones who are the Lord will provide group. You know, we spoke about the people that said the Lord will lead me to my hamburger, the ones that thought that they just sit back and wait for the Lord to bring them their mate. It never occurred to me that you would not understand that I was talking to the male part of the population. I wasn't referring to the females. I think some females thought, well, what other option is there? We have to sit back and wait. And that's right. I was talking about the male, and that's what I want to talk about today. I want to use that as the springboard into a further look into the male relationship, what his role is in the male-female relationship today. Do you know what it is? Do you men know, both of you, who are both those that are married and those who are not married, do you know what your role in the male-female relationship is? Now, if you don't know, if the man does not know his role, the female then is caused to be uncertain about her role. And consequently, she doesn't really understand how she's supposed to act because she's waiting for you to set the stage and waiting for you to set the guidelines so that she'll know how to conduct herself. The women's lib movement would never have gained a hearing at all if the male part of the American population had been functioning as we ought to be functioning as males. But because we haven't known how to function many times, and there have been men who have been turned loose on society, not knowing their responsible role as a man, it's caused this kind of frustration among the female population of America. In Ephesians, the 5th chapter, verses 25 through 33, if you will, turn there. We're going to limit our comments to this passage of Scripture. And I'll ask that you turn and I'll wait on you. Ephesians 5, beginning in verse 25, gives both general and specific guidelines regarding the role that the male plays in this male-female relationship. And I want to read it for you today. I want to limit ourselves and our discussion to simply the general, just the general guidelines that are given regarding the male role in our society. And then we'll talk about the specific ones next Sunday. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. Even so, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no man ever hates his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one. This is a great mystery, and I take it to mean Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. Now, this gives in a very real, genuine way the general and the specific requirements of a man's relationship to a woman, of a husband's relationship to his wife. And I want us to notice them this morning. I want us to notice them primarily under two headings. Man's role to the woman is actually twofold. And I'm beginning to think that it is only twofold. I believe that this sums it all up. I believe when Paul said what he said here, that he simply outlined totally the entire responsibility that the man has toward the woman, that the male has toward the female. And I guarantee something this morning. I guarantee that if we men will function according to the guidelines that are mentioned in this passage in Ephesians, the 5th chapter, it's going to eliminate totally two prevalent conditions that always seemingly exist in our present day society, wherever you have men and women together. It will eliminate two prevalent conditions. Number one, it will eliminate frustration. Number two, it will eliminate impurity. These two things seem always to exist wherever there are males and females placed in a common situation trying to function under God as their head. I think I can say without reservation that in this society here, on campus particularly, we find, and in our homes in the community also, there are these two that exist in practically every situation where there are troubles. When someone comes into counsel, I can either point to one of these or the other as being the real reason why that person is in my office. Either that person is frustrated, or it has to do with the improper, impure conduct between a male and a female. And I guarantee you, if we take this passage here, it will eliminate both of them. Let me illustrate what I mean. The number one function of a man, and I don't mean this in the sense of most important, but it comes first. The number one function of a male toward a female is that the male is to be the initiator. The male is to be the initiator. The female is to be the reciprocator. The man is the inventive initiator. The female is the responsive reciprocator. Now, that's not a role that is unbecoming. It's not a role in which you women would find yourselves cumbered or fettered. I think you would all find yourselves being able to function comfortably as a reciprocator. Sometimes men find themselves ill at ease functioning as an initiator. And it's the men that I'm primarily talking to this morning. I think the ball is in your court or our court as men. I want you to notice in this passage here, watch how many of these verbs are initiating type verbs. Husbands, love your wives. That's initiating. As Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. That's an initiating kind of verb. That he might sanctify her, set her apart as special. That's initiating. And having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word. That's initiating. Present the church to himself. You see, these are all initiating verbs. Love their wives as their own bodies. He nourishes and cherishes his body as Christ does the church. A husband should leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two should become one. All of these, you see, are initiating type verbs. They speak to us as men and say, all right, men, you need to get off the can and get on the stick. This is your job. You're to initiate. The other two verbs that are used here are verbs for the woman, and it says simply that she's to be submissive to her husband and she is to respect her husband. These are responsive kinds of verbs, and they have to do with the woman's initial role or her primary role in the relationship between male and female. Man is the initiator. Woman is to be the reciprocator. We men are the ones who are to get it started. And I'll just put it very plainly. We're the ones who are to get it started. But you may say, but I'm not that by nature. I'm not a very initiating, outgoing person. Well, then what I would recommend that you do is go to that gal that you had your eye on and just say to her, you know, I'm not a very outgoing, initiating person. Yeah, that in itself is being the initiator. And when you get through, making marks in the sand with your toe, you just simply say to her, and you may stutter and you may stammer, but just simply say, you know, this is kind of out of my field. I'm not very much at initiating, but I couldn't stand it any longer. I want to meet you. I want to know who you are. And you know what she'll do? Why, she'll help you. She'll know where to take over from there. These lovely women, they know how to be gracious responders. And she'll even make you think you're initiating it from then on. She knows how to do that. But you need to be the initiator. Men, if you do not initiate, then you frustrate. Any man that does not initiate frustrates. And if we don't stop it, we're going to be the cause of the most of the frustration on the part of the women, wherever we are. I would say that the majority, if not the totality, of the frustration as it comes to social associations on campus, the vast majority, if not the total amount of the frustration caused on campus today is due to the fact that the male part of the population is failing to initiate. And I've had nothing but nods from the girls on campus. I know this to be true. There may be some reasons why the girls are scaring the boys away. One boy said today that when they run in packs, he was dead serious. He said, no man is going to be brave enough to attack a whole herd of you. I think so. So just be careful. But all of that aside, the man's responsibility is the responsibility to initiate. When a woman has to take the initiative, it puts her in a position in which she's not able really or comfortable functioning. She can't really function properly. She doesn't know what is appropriate. There was someone who, out of frustration, wrote this poem. And when I read it, I thought, you know, that's not written by a man, I know. And I know that it's not written by a woman just out of lightness or jest. This woman is actually experiencing the frustrations that I'm referring to this morning. She entitles it, Men. If you smile at him, he thinks you're flirting. If you don't, he thinks you're an iceberg. If you let him kiss you, he wishes you were more reserved. If you don't, he'll seek consolation elsewhere. If you flatter him, he thinks you're simple. If you don't, he thinks you don't appreciate him. If you talk of love and romance, he thinks you're asking him to marry you. If you're a good girl, he wonders why you aren't human. If you return his caresses, he thinks you're cheap. If you don't, he'll find a girl that will. If you go out with other guys, he'll think you're a fickle. If you don't, he thinks no one else will have you. Then she just says, Men. God bless them. They don't know what they want. But you know, that says a lot. It says that that girl who wrote that was really and truly frustrated because she was trying to find herself initiating in a sense because she feels that you don't really and truly know what you're looking for. I believe that we as men need to resume, or if not resume, we need to start our work as an initiator. We need to resign forever from this capacity that we've seemed to fill, that of being a frustrator. Let's stop being frustrators. Let's start being initiators. And I mean initiation in the sense of getting it started, like in courtship. And I mean initiation in the sense of keeping it going, like in marriage. Initiation is not called that just because that's what you do at the beginning of your marriage or at the beginning of your courtship. A lot of men think that that's when you're supposed to do all the, make all the overtures, you know, and make all the not the passes, but the approaches, and that you're to do all this at the beginning. But then later on, when you get married, you can stop all of that. And you know, that's foolishness from then on out once you've gotten married. As one very boorish man said one time, well, you don't keep on running after you've caught the bus. Well, that may be true for buses. But that's not true when it comes to your relationship to your wife or to your girlfriend. We must initiate to keep on going. We must initiate to keep things rolling. We must be the one. From the time that we first meet this person until the time that we finally, having been joined to her in marriage, we find ourselves being parted from her by death, man is to be forever the initiator. You may find it difficult. It will come more easily if you'll just go ahead and break through. My brother Dan spoke out at the camp this weekend, and he said, all you need is one hand to be an initiator. And I thought, well, what in the world are you talking about? He said, all you have to do is just have one hand and go to your wife if you're a bit uptight about saying it or being able to express it, and just say, I love you very much. And just memorize it like that. And get it to where you can say, I love you very much. And then he said, you'll get so that you can just pass through the room where she is and just throw up five fingers and she'll know what you mean. I don't believe I would boil it down that close. I think I would tell her, I love you, and be that initiator. These verbs here in this letter to the Ephesians, the verbs are initiating verbs. But that's not the major role. The major role that man plays is that of protector. He's her protector. Man is the protector. Woman is to be the protected. Now, that's found also in this passage. I want to read. There are two particular ways in which man serves as the protector. Verses 25, 26, and 27, listen to what it says here, that man is to be the protector in the sense that he provides the moral guidelines for that relationship. I believe that the man, as the protector, finds himself using the best safeguard for morality, the best safeguard for purity. Are you having trouble maintaining your discretion and maintaining the way you ought to act toward that girl? Are your sex drives strong toward her? Do you find yourself being put out on a limb and finding yourself conducting yourself in a way that you ought not? Let me show you the cure for it. Look upon her as the one whom you will protect, not assault. Look upon yourself as the protector for that girl. And I guarantee you, it'll revolutionize your relationship to that woman. Let me read these three verses and you'll see how it's used here. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. He sacrificed himself for that wife, for the church, that he might sanctify her. Let me read this, though, in another way. This morning during the service, I thought, well, I'll just read it in case or in terms of the courter, the person who's dating. Boys, love your dates as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, that he might set her apart as something special, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present his date to himself after their date in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she might be holy and without blemish. Now, men, if you can't say that after having dated a girl, that you can present her like that, sanctified, cleansed, holy, without wrinkle or spot or blemish, then you've not approached her as a protector should. But I guarantee you that's the greatest safeguard for purity of any principle that you can put to work in your life. You approach her as her protector. When I was a young boy of 17, something happened that I will treasure for the rest of my life. I was dating a girl at that time who was not a Christian. And at 17, the emotions and the passions of boys and girls run pretty high. And on that particular occasion, this girl made it known to me that she was at my disposal. And I got the message, and she knew that I got the message. What should I have done on that occasion? Well, I turned to her and I said, no, I'm not going to take advantage of you. I said, I love you too much to take any liberty with you. I said, furthermore, don't you let any man who is not your husband take any such liberty with you. And I, in my own estimation of myself that night, I grew a foot. And the many times that I've thought back on that occasion, I've never, ever regretted telling that young girl, I love you too much to take advantage of you. And I served her that night. I didn't know what I was doing, but I served her as her protector. Now, men, you're going to have to serve her as the protector against you, and you're going to have to serve as to protect her against herself, because there are times when her passions will be higher, and there'll be a time when she will be more responsive to your advances. Now, you can do one of two things. You can be very shrewd and watch for those times when her passions are high, and you can move in then and do your own thing and take advantage of it. And if you'll watch closely, you can find. You'll know when it is. And you'll then move in and do your own thing. Or you can be watchful of her needs in that respect. And when that time comes, you can say to her, in essence, by your actions, I'm going to protect you from yourself. I'm not going to take advantage of you. Oh, I wish that we could get that across to ourselves. That is the greatest insurance against impurity of any concept that I can think of. But the second thing, this thing of being the protector is the best provider of security that the Bible ever has made available to us. Listen, look at verses 28 and 29. Even so, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no man ever hates his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it as Christ does the church. Now that's talking about providing security. A woman needs to be protected in the sense that she needs to be provided with security. He says here, no man ever hates his own flesh. What he's saying really is that no man in his right mind hates his own flesh. That a man doesn't go around hitting himself in the head with a hammer. Why? Well, because no man in his right mind does that. No man goes around cutting himself, or no man goes around running himself up against a wall if he's in his right mind. And if you see people, men or women, doing that kind of a thing to themselves, you should call the hospital and let the little men in white garments, you know, their coats, come put bindings around that fellow and take him off to the asylum because he's not in his right mind. Any man that would treat or abuse or misuse his wife, whether it be emotionally or physically or financially or whatever may be the abuse, that man also is not in his right mind. For no man in his right mind abuses his own body, his own flesh. And the wife, and in one sense the date, she's the reflection of your own flesh. And the way that you treat her is a reflection of the way, really, you're treating yourself. These two words here that are used, I don't know of any two words that are so beautiful in this context than the two words nourish and cherish. Now, I think of the word nourish being more on the sense of the physical, in the sense of providing food and housing, you know, and clothing. He nourishes her, and that's needed. And if any man won't provide for the needs of his own household, he's worse than an unbeliever. But he doesn't stop by just saying the nourishing part. You notice how he says that he cherishes her, to cherish. That is a very rich word. It's beautiful. What do you think it means? What does it convey to you, to cherish? Oh, boy, that's fantastic when it comes to a relationship between a man and his wife. He cherishes her. In other words, he values her highly. But it has to do with the gentle care and the loving concern that a man has for his wife. It means that he looks out for her emotional needs. The whole thing is just wrapped up in one beautiful statement that he cherishes her. Can it be said about you men and us men that we nourish and cherish our wives? Well, that's part of it here. He says that this is what's necessary. So you have this being then the basic and really the ultimate function of a man toward his wife or toward his date. He must serve as the initiator from the very minute that he begins the association until he dies. He must, in that process, serve as her protector, in the sense that it safeguards her purity and in the sense that it provides her with security. Men, I guarantee you, if we'll function on this plane, that we will initiate, it will remove the frustration that's present, and if we will then serve as her protector, it will serve to keep us pure and it'll serve her in providing her security. I guarantee you, this will revolutionize your life as you, as men, take the initiative effort, and go right on through life serving her in that capacity. I want to give you in closing a picture of two homes, or one picture of one home and a picture of another home. Both of these letters that I received came in the mail 2 weeks ago yesterday. One of them is begun with this statement: "You have my permission to use this letter in counseling or sermons if you think it can help others." Listen to this statement by this woman: "I'm writing because I feel desperate. I'm scared. My marriage needs help, and I don't know where to turn. Before marriage, my husband was so thoughtful. The first few months of our marriage, he was constantly leaving notes or doing little things that said, 'You're special.' This was one reason why I married him. He knew the little things that he did made me feel loved. Right now, my house is a mess. Sex is a chore, and I'm irritable with my children. On recent anniversaries, he has said, 'I had too much to do to bother with getting you something.' I knew money was too scarce to buy something, but a card can be bought for 25 cents. A note would have cost less. My birthdays are ignored. It isn't that I want things. I want him and his attention. It boils down to the fact that he feels, so he says, that since we're married, little things are not necessary. After all, he makes the living, and we do have what we need, but I'm starving emotionally. I've tried talking. When I'm ignored, however, all day, it's hard to be responsive at night. I don't like to feel like a maid and a mistress. I want to be a sweetheart and wife. And if he'd just be more thoughtful. I love him too much to ever leave him, but I wonder at times if I'll be like others, just build my life around my children. Please, please," and she underlines those two words, "in these sermons you're preaching, try to get across the importance of courting after marriage. An unexpected note means so much. A single flower occasionally means more than a large bouquet once every 3 years. I need his attention so much because I love him more than anyone in the world." Men, let me say something. Let's none of us be so small as to go home after this service and ask our wife if she wrote that. Don't do that. There are probably 300 or 400 of us in here who very well could reasonably think, "My wife wrote that," because many times that's the way we act. But don't you do that. You know what we need to do? We need to look real closely at ourselves and see, by the way, am I causing my wife to be emotionally starved? And if I am, then I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to change. That's not a very happy picture of a home, but it can be changed. But you know whose responsibility it is? It's us men. It's our responsibility. Now listen to this other letter. This came the same mail in the same day. It was written on August the 8th, 1963, by a man who at that time was 77 years old. He was away from home on his wife's birthday. That would have been a good enough excuse. You know, what kind of excuse would you need than be out of the state, you know, on your wife's birthday? "Oh, honey, I was gone. Not this man. At 77 now, he wrote this: "My beloved wife, 76 years ago today, a baby girl was born in Ozark, Missouri, where after 21 years, on April the 3rd, 1910, she became my helpmeet and took upon herself my name. And for 55 years, we have loved and trusted each other until we have become like each other. Soon after we were married, we took upon ourselves the name of Christ and trusted in him who said, 'I will never fail you, I will never forsake you.' And he certainly has kept his promises. God in his providence has blessed us in so many ways that we can never, ever thank him enough. A wonderful family with wonderful daughters-in-laws, with wonderful grandchildren who are all active members of the Lord's church. God has blessed us with health and strength.
well beyond 70 years. Praise Him evermore. You can never know how much you have helped me to live the Christian life. Hand in hand with greater love, we are nearing the end of the journey. A devoted husband. That's beautiful, isn't it? This letter came from one of our elders who is now deceased, our brother J.A. Thompson. He wrote that some 13 years ago to his beloved Miss Birdie. Now, those are two pictures, and men, it's up to you as to which one you make the picture of your home. Brother Thompson was a very unusual man in many respects. On his 90th year, they found him walking up or climbing up a ladder onto his roof with a roll of tar paper on his shoulder. He's going up there to patch a leak in his roof so Miss Birdie wouldn't get wet this winter. He's still protecting her at 90 years old, still courting her at 76. Men, the ball is in your court. It's in our court, mine and yours. And I'm calling upon you, by the grace of God, to take the initiative. Get it going. Take the initiative in keeping it going. But be the protector of that woman and keep it going on the right track. And be that which provides not only for her in the sense of her emotional and moral protection, but provides for her security. Be her initiator. Be her protector. And you ladies then graciously be the responder and be the one who graciously accepts his protection. May God bless us for these words, and may He lead us into greater family life as we draw closer to each other and to Him. We're going to sing this song of invitation. It's directed primarily to those of us who are Christians as we order our lives in our relationship to each other. Will you respond as you, however you may need, as we stand and sing?
I love thee, I know.